many people who don't really understand the situation. They don't even really know what's happening until their children are coming home with these books. I believe that if there was a transparent media, this petition would have signatures in the millions.
So far, the protests have largely received negative coverage, with the establishment refusing to budge on the RSE curriculum. Activists believe this uncompromising stance could boil over to more parent protests in 2023. Robert Carter, London.
Yemenis are growing frustrated with the United Nations' failure to condemn the Saudi-led war on Yemen, or to hold them responsible for the ensued disastrous ramifications. This comes just days after the UN Special Envoy for Yemen, Hans Grundberg, addressed the United Nations Security Council about the situation in Yemen. While calling for an end to violence, Grundberg declined to condemn the ongoing Saudi artillery shelling that has killed or injured dozens of civilians in the northern province of Saada.
I call on the parties to respect international humanitarian law. Military activity, combined with negative rhetoric and escalatory political and economic measures, create a situation where a simple miscalculation could reignite a cycle of violence that will be difficult.
Grundberg also called for humanitarian aid to Yemen, but mentioned nothing about the lifting of the Saudi blockade, which is the main obstacle preventing vital aid and food supplies from entering the country. This military general we spoke with on the streets of the Yemeni capital says the United Nations is the root cause of all evil in Yemen.
The UN destroys every country they get involved in. Look at what they did in Iraq, Syria, Libya, and Sudan. As for Yemen, the United Nations and all of its envoys' efforts in Yemen have been directed at spying on Yemenis, instigating conflicts among Yemenis and fueling chaos and instability.
Some Yemenis are calling on their government to abandon all political talks with the UN. They accuse the UN of complicity with the Saudi-led coalition in the killing of Yemenis. The Yemeni government stated that if the blockade is not lifted and salaries are not paid, the only option left is war.
The Yemeni people and government have expressed that the 8-year Saudi-imposed siege on Yemen must be broken by any means necessary. This after years of failed political efforts to resolve the conflict by the United Nations, an entity which most Yemenis lost trust in and accused of supporting the Saudi military aggression on Yemen. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Tehran has hosted the first International Congress on Influential Women. The 2-day event is underway in the Iranian capital with the participation of influential, active and elite women from almost 90 world countries. Addressing the Congress, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi called on the participating women at the Congress to benefit from the experiences of the Islamic Republic of Iran with regard to women's rights.
We hope that the participants of this Congress, through cooperation and interaction, will be able to take necessary measures for the rights of women in the world and benefit from the experiences of the Islamic Republic of Iran in the field of protecting women's rights and paying special attention to women's role in the society. I hope this Congress will prepare the ground for further cooperation among countries in this field.
The event is aimed at identifying, supporting and developing the abilities and capabilities of elite and influential women at national and international level.
Women are suffering worldwide. This is just because we have not been together. And most importantly, this is the very first time for the Islamic country of Iran to host such a big occasion. So I am so happy to be here, and I hope the relationship with our sisters, women in the world, we should work hard, very strongly, and look forward to the international world to assist women than ever before.
It is extremely important to integrate women in peace building process. So this conference is extremely important because we know that we have a peace threatened in many parts of the world. And when we look for solutions, women should be involved.
Special awards with international recognition are slated to be granted to influential women in three fields of science and technology, economic and social affairs.
The Congress International of the Women, it's very important for the women in the Islam. For the development, the communication with the country, for example, Algeria, the woman Algeria and the woman Iraq, and it take the relation very important because the Islam, it's number one.
The influential women have been selected from among housewives, women employees, female social activists, as well as competent women in digital technology, social media, science and technology, entrepreneurship, and those who are pioneers in areas of culture and charity affairs.
On the sidelines of the Congress, a memorandum of understanding was signed among Afghanistan's neighboring countries at the initiative of Iran's Vice President for Women and Family Affairs to help Afghan girls and women continue their education. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
The heads of the main EU institutions defended the 27-nation bloc's foreign policy during a debate in the European Parliament on Wednesday. They insisted that sending deadly weapons to Ukraine, costing billions of euro, is the only way to thwart Russia. Most lawmakers agree, but not all.
We see militarization, we see escalation. We are not really seeing a call for peace. We assume it will be the people who suffer the cost of sanctions.
Interest rates continue to rise in the eurozone and inflation remains extremely high. Sanctions against Moscow and the rapid move away from Russia's energy are the main reasons.
The cost of the living crisis affecting our European citizens unfortunately persists, and we are therefore concerned that the European Council conclusions fail to prioritize the support for our citizens.
Experts warn public support in the EU for the seemingly never-ending cash flow to Ukraine will eventually wane if the war persists, resulting in political consequences.
There can be a kind of danger, which is already looming, that very populistic parties, they can use this as an argument to say, look, this is something we have to cater for our own needs first, and then we have to see what's going to happen in Ukraine.
In an unprecedented departure from diplomacy on Wednesday, the European Council President Charles Michel accused authorities in Iran of operating a, quote, brutal regime. He says more sanctions against Tehran will be announced on Monday. Some lawmakers oppose the policy.
The EU and its partners never stop violating international law, going above multilateral institutions like the UN with their own parallel systems, including punishing millions of people around the world through our authoritarian unilateral sanction regime.
By insisting that rioters in Iran are peaceful protesters and by attempting to directly implicate the Islamic Republic in the Ukraine war, impartial analysts say the EU is being opportunistic, suggesting the new sanctions are trumped up and politically motivated. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
From hero to zero, and claps don't pay the bills. Some of the chants by nurses here and across the country on strike again in a dispute with government over not just pay, but patient safety. Emma has been a nurse for more than three decades.
For a long time, we've felt we haven't been able to give the care we want to give because we're so pressed for time, resources, simply just numbers on the ground. So I think for a long time, we've wanted things to change, and it's come to the point where something has to change, and this is really our only option. Nothing else is working.
The reason behind that, more than 10 years of underfunding and neglect.
Across the country, the health service has been facing what's been described as an intolerable and unbearable strain due to a combination of COVID, the seasonal flu, and staff shortages, with some patients having to wait up to 24 hours for a bed inside a hospital such as this one.
That plus a record 7 million patients on the NHS waiting list, described as a national scandal. The Royal College of Nursing Union demanded a 19% pay rise when they first went on strike last year, but has since cut that in half. Yet a deal is yet to be reached. The Health Secretary, James Cleverly, says the strikes put patients' lives at risk. Last week, the government introduced legislation that, if passed,
will enable employers to sue unions and fire employees if they refuse to work on strike days.
Rather than talking about the pay negotiation, talking about safer staffing and the safety and quality of care that we're giving up and down the country in our hospitals, the government have gone down this sort of anti-strike, anti-trade union route. So, once again, so it's interesting to talk about safe staffing levels on a strike day, but what about the other 365 days in the year when we have not enough nurses on duty, not enough doctors, not enough physiotherapists, cancellations of operations and delayed chemotherapy? What about those days? What about safer staffing on a normal NHS day?
The UK has been hit by months of public sector strikes from rail to mail, all of whom say they're in for the long haul. In the weeks ahead, more strikes are planned by nurses, paramedics, and ambulance drivers, with the Royal College of Nursing warning it'll be their biggest walkout yet if pay talks with the government do not progress soon. Sai Purza, London.
Gaza, the symbol of resistance. This is the title of the conference held in Tehran. Attended by Iranian officials and members of Palestinian resistance groups, the event seeks to shed light on Palestinian suffering under more than seven decades of Israeli occupation, with Gaza bearing the title of an icon for the struggle for freedom.
Gaza, the 360 square kilometer, besieged over 17 years maybe, and with this dire situation, the people over there will manage to steadfast, to confront the continuous aggressions and offensive from the Israeli forces against our civilians, against our common people in Gaza.
The event is held on the anniversary of the 22-day resistance in the Gaza Strip in late 2008 and early 2009, where Palestinians resisted Israel's military offensive.
Today was the day that in Iran we remember the resistance of the Palestinian people in Gaza district after the invasion of the Israeli troops in 2008. On that year, the Israeli troops invaded oppressed people of the Palestinian in Gaza district. And in Iran, every year we remember that.
This year's edition of the annual conference seeks to recognize late Iranian General Qasem Soleimani's role in strengthening the resistance axis in Palestine.
When we talk about freedom, when we talk about resistance, when we talk about Palestine, you cannot miss the name of Shahid Soleimani. Shahid Soleimani is a big icon for us in Palestine and resistance movement to defend our own legitimate right. Shahid Soleimani was a big brother to us.
General Soleimani was killed along with his fellow comrades in January 2020 near Baghdad International Airport in a drone strike launched by the U.S. The Iranian military commander spearheaded major operations in Syria and Iraq that led to the defeat of Daesh and recapturing of key areas from the terror group.
People here say General Soleimani was a key element in the resistance front, who had plans to liberate Palestine from the Israeli occupation. They say this was a major reason why the U.S. assassinated him. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Former EU lawmaker Pierre Antonio Panzeri was among those arrested by Belgian police last month as part of a probe into a cash-for-favour scheme allegedly involving Qatar and Morocco. He has just signed a deal with prosecutors to name names in return for a reduced sentence. On Tuesday, during a debate in the European Parliament on the scandal, the EU itself was accused of corruptly targeting some of its own member states.
No peace without justice. Whose secretary has been arrested for corruption? This organization was financed by the EU, France and Germany. What a coincidence, because this very organization focused on attacking Poland.
Belgian police have recovered more than 1.5 million euro in cash following dozens of raids. So far, the scandal mainly involves members of the S&D political grouping in the European Parliament.
Since the accusations emerged in December, we in the Socialists and Democrats group have been working intensively to try and implement reforms to combat corruption. We have to ensure accountability, transparency, and integrity.
Sitting Greek MEP Eva Kaili is among four currently behind bars awaiting trial. Lawmakers are demanding that an EU-wide ethics body is established. Aside from the Parliament scandal, each year millions of euro go unaccounted for from the EU budget. This as ordinary citizens struggle to make ends meet.
It's a serious source of concern, and we also see that there is very little progress made on poverty and social exclusion, which remains at very high level in the EU.
Some lawmakers say the EU is showing a great deal of hypocrisy, given that so much is said here about rule of law problems elsewhere. Sources tell us Belgian police will almost certainly be making more arrests in the coming days as part of the European Parliament corruption probe. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Israeli settler attacks against Palestinians are a normal reality in villages around Nablus, threatening everyone's lives. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of the Electronic Intifada wrote, Ahmad Dawabish does not like to look back. He has good reason. The 12-year-old survived one of the worst settler attacks in recent years when his family's home in the village of Douma in the occupied West Bank district of Nablus was firebombed by Israeli settlers in 2015. Ahmad's 18-month-old brother Ali was burned to death. His father, Saad, died a week later from his injuries. Riham, Ahmad's mother, died a month after that. Ahmad was 4 at the time. He sustained severe burns all over his body, and the attack still casts a dark shadow over life in the village. According to Nasser Dawabish, 48, the uncle who is now raising Ahmad, relations between the villagers in Douma and the Israeli settlers surrounding them have only gotten worse. And since 2015, the village has been attacked at least a dozen more times. As for Ahmad, he's trying to put it behind him. The attack doesn't affect me anymore because I don't allow myself to think about it, Ahmad told the electronic intifaza, sitting on a sofa chair in his uncle's home. He attempts to twirl a football in between his fingers, catching it before it falls on the ground. Ahmad still has burn scars across the right side of his face and across his body. He has had years of reconstructive surgery and skin grafts, and his treatment is far from over. Every 6 months, he must undergo laser skin treatment for the scars, along with hair restoration surgeries and more skin grafts. The family receives special military permission to access this treatment at an Israeli regime hospital. "We don't feel happy going there inside the occupied territories," Nasser said, adding, "but it is only Israeli hospital that has the medical equipment, so we have no other choice." As tensions soar across the occupied West Bank, the United Nations finding that 2022 has been the deadliest year for Palestinians in the West Bank since it started counting fatalities in 2005, the Dawabish family is left to fend for themselves. Nasser told the electronic intifaza, "We are terrified something like this could happen again. There is no authority here that can protect us from them. We only have God." The Dawabish family's home still stands as it was, blackened with ash and dotted with Ahmad's parents' blankets and belongings in the room where they sustained the burns that would eventually kill them. On one of the walls, someone has scribbled, "We will never forgive." They decided to leave the home this way to act as a proof and testament to the violence Israeli settlers have inflicted on us, Nasser said. The ringleader of the attack was then 21-year-old Amiram Ben Oleil, who was at the time living in a bus in the Odei Ad settlement outpost, which overlooks Duma. He was allegedly part of the Hilltop Youth, an extremist and nationalist group of Israeli settlers who agitate for a Jewish theocracy from which Gentiles, non-Jews, are expelled. While all Israeli settlements in the Palestinian territory are considered illegal under international law, the Zionist regime only considers outposts illegal. It nonetheless provides them with state-funded protection and access to water and electricity. They're often retroactively legalized, and the new Israeli coalition regime has reportedly pledged to confer legal status on all remaining outposts in its first 60 days in power. The Hilltop Youth are fiercely anti-Palestinian. They are accused of being behind the so-called price tag attacks in which settlers target Palestinians and their properties in revenge for outposts being demolished by the Zionist regime's military. Ben Oleil was represented by the lawyer Itamar Ben-Gvir, now the ultra-right leader of the Otzma Yehudit, who is set to become National Security Minister, a newly created position in Benjamin Netanyahu's latest and most extreme coalition regime. According to prosecutors, Ben Oleil began his journey that night from Yeshuv Hadat, a nearby settlement outpost. He staked out homes in Douma to attack, first throwing a Molotov cocktail into an empty house. He then moved on to Dawabish family's home. One Molotov was thrown through the Dawabish bedroom window while the family was asleep. Ben Oleil also sprays painted revenge on the outside of the home before the attack. The indictment claims that Ben Oleil acted alone in the attack with one unidentified suspect who was a minor at the time, striking a plea deal that saw him convicted only as an accessory. However, eyewitnesses claim that they saw at least two masked men fleeing from the scene that night. In 2020, an Israeli regime court issued a triple life sentence against Ben Oleil, who had been convicted on 3 counts of murder and 2 counts of attempt murder. The Shin Bet, an Israeli regime spying agency at the time, said the ruling was an important milestone in the battle against Jewish terror. But the rare sentencing of a Jewish settler for crimes committed against Palestinians has done little to comfort the Dawabish family. Nasser said it wasn't enough, standing outside the charred remains of the family's home, adding, "It will never bring back the dead, and it wasn't the act of one person. If it wasn't for the government and army supporting these settlers, then they would never have come to burn our family alive. It is the Zionist regime and the occupation itself that should be on trial," Nasser said. "Not just one settler," he said. The court had also fined Ben Oleil just under $75,000, which was to be given as compensation to Ahmad. Nasser says the family has still not received any money. Nasser told the Electronic Intifada, "These settlers are still attacking us, and they are still taking our land. Nothing has changed." Just a week after Ahmad's family was targeted in an arson attack, another Palestinian family's home near Douma was also attacked with Molotov cocktails. No injuries were reported in that attack. Nablus in particular has seen a sharp increase in coordinated and armed settler attacks over the past few months under Israeli regime army protection. This is due in part to Palestinian resistance operation against the Zionist regime troops and Zionist settlers in Nablus and other West Bank cities, as well as the arrival of the annual olive harvest season, in which many Palestinians are permitted to access their lands near Israeli settlements and outposts, and which is often accompanied by a spike in settler assaults. According to the UN, there have been nearly 800 settler attacks against Palestinians and their property in 2022. At least 175 Palestinians have been killed by the Israeli regime army in the West Bank and Gaza during 2022. Douma has had its share of this increase in settler violence. On June 16, 2022, a car near Douma was set on fire by settlers armed with metal batons. They smashed the car's windshield and a side window and pepper sprayed the two men inside. On the same day, a couple with their 3-year-old daughter and 1-month-old infant were also attacked by Israeli settlers who were standing beside an Israeli regime military jeep. The settlers kicked their car, smashed one of the windows and a front headlight with a baton, and pepper sprayed the couple and their babies.
Thank you. Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The U.S. is covertly sponsoring Daesh terrorists. That is a claim that Moscow has made when it comes to the Daesh in Afghanistan. But why would the U.S. do that? Russia says the U.S. wants to take revenge on the Taliban for its defeat. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether our guests agree on this stance by Russia. We'll also take a look at other instances of U.S. support for Daesh terrorists and what gains the U.S. was looking for with this association, which, based on its track record, has not been anything substantial. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Daniel Kovalik, professor of international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, joins us from Pittsburgh, PA. Also joining us is Fra Hughes, journalist, author, and activist, who joins us from Belfast. Welcome to you both. Daniel Kovalik, first over to you. So the U.S. reaching out to armed groups that oppose the Taliban and also secretly giving money to Daesh, that is what Russia's presidential envoy for Afghanistan has said. What do you think?
Well, I mean, why would anybody be surprised by this? The U.S., of course, was the one that supported the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, beginning actually in mid-1979, before the Soviet Union had a presence there. And, of course, the Mujahideen was a jihadist terrorist group. One of its leaders, of course, was Osama bin Laden, who went on to form al-Qaeda. So the U.S. has been working with terrorist groups, certainly as far back as the 80s. And since then, we know that the U.S. and NATO, you know, partnered with jihadists in Libya to overthrow Gaddafi. They then helped those same jihadists in Libya to travel to Syria to try to overthrow Assad. And the U.S. supported jihadists in Syria against Assad. So this is really par for the course for the United States.
Okay, this is where, Fra Hughes, we need to have you help us or help the ones who are not a believer of this or who do not accept this association between the U.S. and terrorist groups as to how that does happen. Because Daniel Kovalik talked about how it supported jihadists in Libya, then jihadists in Syria. His word was jihadists. We call them terrorists. As to how the U.S. Has done this and why it has done this and why did it resort to the terrorist formula as it saw?
Well, firstly, if you take a look at American history, I mean, America claims to have got its freedom from the British Empire in 1776. And then for 225 years, out of 247 years of American modern history as an independent state, America has been at war with its neighbors or somewhere else within the globe. So American, not American people, but the American administration and the people behind these wars and the bankers for 225 years have been profiteering from war and profiting from the misery and the death and the maimings that they bring to other sovereign nations. I mean, you could even throw Ukraine into this. I mean, a lot of people believe it's a proxy war. The Americans are going to fight to the last drop of Ukrainian blood in order to destabilize Russia. So if we take that as the most recent example and just move backwards, we can see that America uses proxy armies in order to carry out its dirty work when it's frightened to get its own boots on the ground. Indeed, there were instances in Syria where the Americans supposedly were dropping arms to their allies within Syria, which unfortunately and kind of uncontrollably fell into the path of Daesh. And the Syrian army has claimed before that their positions have been attacked by American forces prior to Daesh, ISIS assaults on their positions. So, you know, there is a history of this. There is a history of the proxy wars where the American administration uses other people to carry out their fights. And one other example would be when America and its allies invaded Iraq. It was about 6 months after the invasion of Iraq that we began to witness the bombings of the various mosques. Now, to my mind, that was used by America and especially Britain in order to sow division and civil war within Iraq. While Iraqis were fighting each other, they were not fighting the occupation. Sure. And I think America wants to see Afghanistan to continue to be disabled because it's on the borders with Iran. And you never know who they could try and bring to power as a pro-Western puppet regime in the future.
Yeah, we're going to discuss some of those examples in greater detail and maybe even more examples of this U.S. Association with these terrorists in one form or another. Going back to what the Russian envoy has said, and this is pretty interesting, Daniel Kovalik, he has said the Americans have been acting this way, quote, because they really want to avenge their shameful military political defeat in Afghanistan, and in retaliation, they do everything so that peace is not established in this troubled land. Now, I'm curious as to how this can be understood. I mean, it wasn't bad enough that they occupied the land for over 20 years. It wasn't bad enough that nothing that they promised really panned out. But now that they have pulled out and left the country in tatters, they wanted to destroy it more by supporting this group. I mean, are they supporting then by default these terrorists that are bombing instances where we know that it has led to many civilian deaths?
Well, yes, I think that is probably the case. And again, this seems to be the current modus operandi of the United States in its foreign policy, particularly in West Asia. When you look at the wreckage that the U.S. and NATO have left behind in a place like Libya, which was a very stable country under Gaddafi, very prosperous. Of course, the U.S. and NATO bombed that country to smithereens, left it broken. Now there's slaves being sold in public markets. Libya may never be restored to a stable country. The same can be said of Iraq. The same can be said of Afghanistan itself. It seems that actually destruction is the goal many times. And why would that be? I don't think it's purely out of spite, though in the case of Afghanistan, there was probably some of that. But it's because the U.S. has decided that it's easier to rule and to exploit other people's resources and labor if there's no unified, stable state that governs, right? I think another example of this is the Democratic Republic of Congo, where the U.S. has supported proxies as well for many years, which have gone in and killed literally millions of Congolese, but again, to maintain instability in that country so that the West can just, plunder the resources there without limit, without having to pay taxes. I think that's what we're seeing. That is U.S. foreign policy.
In the case of Afghanistan, however, just as a segue here, that, I'm sorry, Frahius, it appears that the U.S. would have a lot to actually benefit when it has an unstable Afghanistan, given the fact that you have this Russian envoy stating what it has in terms of the U.S. terrorist connection. Because you have, on the one hand, Iran on the one side, and then you have China. You have also Russia, in a sense, where the Russian envoy has actually blamed the U.S. also for wanting to support this because it wants to go after Russia. So the U.S. Can benefit from this association when it comes to three of its, whatever you want to call them, arch foes or what have you. In this case in point, Afghanistan's destabilization through these terrorists can be a way for the U.S. to get to these countries. Is that one or a correct way of looking at this?
I'm not sure. I would say that there's definitely possibilities for further destabilization of Iran, depending on what parts of the country Daesh in Afghanistan could possibly control with the armaments and the finances coming through from America. But America claimed it attacked Afghanistan because of 9/11. But when they put in their puppet president, Mohammad Karzai, at the very beginning, the first actual kind of presidential decree he signed, I believe, was an order to allow a gas pipeline to travel through Afghanistan. That may have been previously banned or not the case under a previous regime. I agree. I don't think it's about revenge. America cares nothing about Afghanistan or the Afghan people. I believe when they pulled out, they were purely pivoting towards China. So they've withdrawn their forces in Afghanistan in order to regroup both for Ukraine and for any forthcoming kind of action against or to China. So I think that's why they left. I mean, America could have stayed on in Afghanistan. You know, the Taliban had the countryside, but the Allies and the Americans had the cities. So they could have just stayed in perpetuity with a low-level war in order to plunder the resources of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. But I think they have, you know, they have their chess pieces on the global board. And if we look even further back, you know, when America was focused on Latin America, we had dictatorship and people that were supported brutal dictatorships, brutal right-wing fascist regimes that tortured and murdered and disappeared their own citizens. That was all with the backing of America. So America, as it changes its foreign policy, following its, you know, its eye on where it's looking to exploit next, then that's why we have seen the war in Ukraine, the wars in West Asia, and potential wars going forward with a potential proxy with Taiwan and Japan against China. So it's a very dangerous, very sinister campaign that that the American administration is following.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Yeah, and Danny Kovalik, when we first started out, you talked about the statements made by the former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in terms of the Mujahideen, I think is what you said. And interestingly, in some sense, back in 2014, the former U.S. President Barack Obama hosted a two-day strategy meeting. I'm looking at this one particular case in point, where he met with the intelligence chiefs of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, Jordan, and some other Middle Eastern countries. And what the purpose of that meeting was, this two-day security meeting, was to refocus military aid away from the al-Nusra Front and, well, they call it ISIS, we call them Daesh, towards more moderate groups of what they called rebels. So when you take a look at the type of involvement with these terrorist groups through its allies, okay, we're seeing an extensive penetration that they had, not penetration, connection that they had with these groups in a variety of levels and based on a variety of different terrorist groups. And of course, that was 9 years ago, back in 2014. These types of relationships have been going on for quite some time, right?
Well, yeah, and I believe it was in 2014 that Joseph Biden, then vice president, said that there were no moderate rebels in Syria, and that therefore the rebels we were supporting were not moderate, meaning they were in fact the very terrorists we claimed we were fighting against. In fact, that could be said about the Free Syrian Army, which the U.S. openly supported for a time, and which committed terrorist acts in Syria, including trying to destroy Christian churches. in cities like Mooloolah and Homs and elsewhere. So, yeah, I mean, we know for sure that the support for those types of groups goes back that far and even farther. You know, Seymour Hersh, who won the Pulitzer Prize, a great Western journalist, he wrote an article back in, I want to say, 2007, maybe, saying that even by like 2005, George W. Bush had pivoted away from fighting terrorism to actually at times partnering with terrorists to try to weaken Syria, weaken Iran. And let's remember, the U.S. Has supported the MEK over time, the MEK being a terrorist group that's killed tens of thousands of Iranian civilians. So, again, nothing is surprising about this. This is par for the course. The sad part is that few Americans realize it. But the truth is out there. And again, there's many officials in the U.S. government who at times have admitted this.
Sad part, I think, sadder even than that, is the fact that we here in the Islamic Republic are being labeled as terrorists. Not we, but the government. That's a whole other topic for another Spotlight program. Okay, so the U.S., Frahues, has a base in Syria. Not far from it, there are terrorists that are there. And for years now, even though it's illegally occupying that part of Syrian territory, it's been saying that it's there to eradicate terrorists. Why doesn't it get rid of the terrorists there? Why is it that, for example, Russia has said that the Al-Tanf military base, terrorists are roaming freely around in that area, and also has accused the U.S. of training some of these terrorists? What do you think of those statements from Russia?
Firstly, I'd have to say I've always been very impressed by the spokespeople that the Russian government has fronting their foreign policy. They seem to be people of integrity, people of honor, and people of honesty, and who refreshingly appear to tell the truth and paint the picture as it's seen on the ground in Syria and Ukraine and Afghanistan and anywhere they choose to see what's happening under kind of Western imperialism. I believe fully that America will be training the Daesh terrorists in Syria. They're still there stealing the wheat of the Syrian people. They're still there stealing the oil. So we're back to the wars for profit that continually seems to be the background to these conflicts. I would fully believe that America is not only training and arming and financing Daesh in Syria, but I would be fairly convinced that they are directing them. The only ointment in the eye here at the moment appears to be Turkey's growing fraternal relationship with Syria and Russia, and it's distancing itself from America, and perhaps it's going to join the new kind of Belt and Road initiative, the new Silk Road, to bring more prosperity and more jobs to Turkey. So I believe the Russians, and I would believe them a lot sooner than I would ever believe one word of a British, European, or American politician or spokesperson.
Let's go back to the year 2012. I know it's a long time ago, Daniel Kovalik, but I'm wondering if you remember this. This was a case that went to trial in London of a Swedish man that was accused of terrorism in Syria. Again, I don't know if you recall that. And you have this man being tried in court, and then all of a sudden, it's not all of a sudden, but then it became clear that the courts were not aware that British intelligence had actually been arming the terrorists that defendant was charged with. I don't know if you remember that. It was quite a case where later on, based on a particular source, reports were cited that MI6 had cooperated with the CIA on a rat line, as it was called, of arms transfers from Libyan stockpiles to the Syrian terrorists. So that's a clear case in point of how you have different intels of the countries, in this case the U.S. and the U.K., cooperating together to arm terrorists. I know this is, again, old news, but don't you think this serves as a clear case in point of U.S. and, of course, the U.K. Support behind terrorists?
Well, yes, and I don't remember that particular case, but what I do remember is, again, another Seymour Hersh article called Red Lines and Rat Lines about the very phenomenon you were talking about the U.K. and the U.S. Supporting terrorists in Syria. And by the way, Seymour Hersh really, after writing that, had a hard time getting published anywhere because no one in the West wanted to hear the truth about that. The other thing in 2012 was that the Defense Intelligence Agency, the DIA, I believe, they had a classified document that somehow was leaked that, again, admitted that the U.S. was supporting groups in Syria whose intentions were to set up a caliphate in Syria. And so, again, all these things are pretty evident that the U.S. has been secretly supporting these groups for many years.
The question that comes to mind here, it's a very simple question, Frau Hughes, and forgive me if I'm asking this, but why does the U.S. have to subscribe to terrorists? Why doesn't it just go after who it wants to go after, which it does, through its own army? Is it that incapable that it has to subscribe to terrorists?
I think it's possibly cheaper to use someone else. If you remember the Vietnam War with so many American casualties that the American people eventually turned against the administration and demanded that their troops be brought home, that hasn't happened in recent conflicts because we saw shock and awe. What you've actually seen is the America as the number one superpower, having such a tactical advantage on the rest of the world. I mean, attacking Afghanistan and attacking Iraq and Libya and Syria, these are countries that could not possibly militarily stand up to America. But I do believe it's easier to try and install a proxy government. It's easier to pay other people to do the dirty work and do the fighting. And rather than put a huge amount of American boots on the ground and therefore kind of exposing them to potential attack by a revolutionary army of national liberation. I mean, when you create Daesh, I believe America created that with Saudi Arabia. So it was Saudi tech fury, fanatical kind of fundamentalist Islamists who are following the wrong path in Islam by following the route of terrorism. I mean, they were financed by Saudi Arabia and they were backed by America. And Turkey allowed them to enter into Syria. So there's a little triumvirate there that allowed this war on Syria to take place. So it's easy for the American Congress to vote, to give money to the military budget, and then the black hole that appears in the CIA accountability of those finances and the Pentagon and stuff, that they can just run off, buy arms, buy weapons, buy mercenaries, because that's what Daesh is. It's a mercenary army paid for by America and Saudi Arabia. And when you think of the likes of the White Helmets, they were the kind of propaganda wing for Daesh in Syria. I mean, they